Visiting Fantastic Worlds with Bonnie Baratti, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. Worlds Fantastic, Worlds Familiar is the new book by JPL scientist Bonnie Baratti. We'll tour the solar system with her on today's show. With every solution comes new challenges, says Bill Nye. He'll explain as we talk about accessing the internet from anywhere on Earth. And Bruce Betts will help us find the connections among hamsters, Skylab, and gold on What's Up. Curiosity, the Mars Science Laboratory rover, was busily exploring the red planet while senior editor Emily Lakdawalla was on sabbatical. Emily, we mentioned but didn't provide any detail on your Curiosity update that you posted. Now it's been a couple of weeks, but still very current. You had a lot to cover. What, 2.5 months worth?
Pretty much. It was a lengthy campaign that Curiosity took to study the southern half of the Bagno dune field, studying the sand dunes in four different locations, taking a look at the sand, and finally sampling in the final spot.
Well, the Gorgiosity, a lot of images in this, begin right up at the top with this beautiful banner looking forward toward those hills in Curiosity's future. But it was another image, or really a matrix of images, that grabbed me. Last weekend, I was on the Central California coast, and I bent over, picked up a handful of sand, fairly coarse sand, and was just really taken with it, as I am by these images in this blog post.
Yeah, it's four different views of sand from the four different science stops. And, you know, sand, meh, you know, it's just, you think it's just a bunch of little grains. But anytime you pick up a pile of sand and look at it really closely, you realize that each grain of sand is a rock. Every rock tells a story. These rocks are all different colors. They're different little rounded mineral grains. They started out as volcanic rocks, probably from some great distance away. They've been sorted into similar size piles by the wind and all rounded into these round shapes. It's really quite lovely just imagining the whole geologic history behind these piles of sand.
And this is the closest that I'll come to holding a handful of Martian sand in my hand. Tell us about the status of the spacecraft. It's still facing some challenges.
It is. I think that Curiosity's challenges aren't more than any other middle-aged creature might have. Because it is, you know, it's several years into the mission. It's a little bit past its warranty. The main problem is with its drill. There is one motor called the drill feed mechanism, and it's absolutely crucial for drilling to work. It's what advances the drill into the ground, and it's having trouble with its brake so that it's hard to get the drill moving. They've been troubleshooting it for a long time. The problem is intermittent. They think that maybe there's a little grain of some material, maybe a chipped tooth from a gear or something, is floating around inside the mechanism, occasionally making it hard for the brake to be released and other times not. They're just having a tough time troubleshooting it because it's so intermittent, and that's prevented them from doing much in the way of sampling activities for quite a while. But the views are great, and Curiosity has lots of other instruments that are keeping busy.
And there is so much more to this post about where Curiosity has been and the work it's doing, but just tell us where it's headed.
Well, now that it's finished this examination of the southern Bagno dune field, it's got about a kilometer of driving, of which it's already done a few hundred meters, to finally get to Vera Rubin Ridge. And that's the name that the mission has adopted to call what they've been calling Hematite Ridge since the beginning of the mission. It's a low standing but still ridge slightly above the regional topography. And from orbit, there's signs of hematite, which is a mineral that forms in liquid water. And so they're expecting to find some interesting geologic history at that site once they finally pull up to it.
I bet they will. Thank you, Emily. It's all from an April 25 post from Emily at planetary.org. Read it and look at the pretty pictures. It's great. Talk to you next week.
Look forward to it, Matt.
She's our senior editor for the Planetary Society, Emily Lakdawalla. Bill Nye is the CEO of the Planetary Society, as well as being the science guy. Bill, you were just telling me that you have a vision for the internet.
A vision for the world, Matt. Three things we want for everybody on Earth. We want clean water, renewably produced, reliable electricity, and access to the internet. Now, providing access to the internet, or whatever the future of electronic worldwide information is called, the CONET. Anyway, we want everybody in the world to have that. And in order to do it, we're not going to be able to run landlines copper wires from the shores of Africa all the way to middle of Africa, for example. So instead, we'll probably provide the internet with orbiting satellites. And in order to make it practical, you have to have a short range. You can't use geosynchronous satellites. There's a second at the speed of light, and then there's electronics on the satellite to process it and get it back down. It's just not the way we use the internet. So instead, we're going to have a constellation, as it's called, of relatively low altitude satellites. And what is SpaceX talking about? 400 to 4,000 of them?
4,000 something little birds.
If you like to worry about space debris, this is a great one. I mean, so if we had two or three companies each putting up 4,000 satellites, you're going to have a lot of debris. But it'd be okay, I guess, as long as we have a means to deorbit them. But this space debris thing, Matt, this is a big deal. And people say, we need a paradigm shift. We need a disruptive, out-of-the-box thinking. We need game-changer technology, which may all be true. But we don't have that right now, and we want to provide internet to everyone in the world. So this problem's really got to be solved. In other words, I don't want to solve one problem and create another. I don't want to get access to the internet for everybody without having a means to deorbit these satellites. Well, Bill, if you had more brains working on it around the world, then maybe they'd come up with a way to deorbit the satellite. And you may be right. You may be right. But we got to figure out this deorbiting thing. And so the first thing, I think, Matt, is to have international treaties that require spacecraft to be able to drag themselves down or retro rocket their way down. If they were drag brought down, perhaps we could use something akin to the solar sail, like light sail one or two. The Planetary Society is the future, Matt.
The fiendish plot of the Planetary Society to become the essential player in low Earth orbit.
Just kidding.
Thank
sort
you.
Of. Thanks, Matt.
Thank
I
you
gotta
very
fly.
Much. He is Bill Nye, the science guy, you know, the CEO of the Planetary Society. Up next, a great planetary scientist, Bonnie Baratti of JPL. She's got a new book out. Bonnie Baratti was just 2 years past achievement of her PhD at Cornell when she went to work for the Jet Propulsion Lab near Pasadena, California. She's now been at JPL for more than 30 years. Along the way, she's worked on many of the missions we talk about on this show, contributing some of the best science to come out of those efforts. NASA awarded her its Exceptional Achievement Medal a few years back. Now she has captured the spirit and wonder of planetary science in her new book, Worlds Fantastic, Worlds Familiar, a guided tour of the solar system, published by Cambridge University Press. She recently made the drive across town for the great conversation you're about to hear. You open the book. Your introduction has a poem from Walt Whitman, which I'm going to read. I should have had the page open. I love Whitman.
He's my favorite poet.
Yeah, he's right up there for me. When I heard the learned astronomer, when the proofs, the figures were ranged in columns before me, when I was shown the charts and the diagrams to add, divide, and measure them, when I, sitting, heard the astronomer, where he lectured with much applause in the lecture room, how soon, unaccountable, I became tired and sick, till rising and gliding out, I'd wandered off by myself in the mystical, moist night air, and from time to time looked up in perfect silence at the stars. We both love Walt, but he was dead wrong, right?
Completely wrong. In fact, I would present the counter argument to that poem, and that is William Herschel. Somebody asked him, why do you do astronomy? And, you know, we get that a lot today, us astronomers, well, isn't it kind of useless? Herschel just said, I don't understand how anyone can look up at the beauty and wonder of the night sky and not want to be an astronomer.
I love that quote.
It's just, there's a beauty to science and math that I think just surpasses the numbers. And if you can get there, it's an experience like poetry or art.
And yet, I always make the comparison to going to an art museum and knowing something about French Impressionism, that it helps you to go even deeper with the amazing beauty, the genius that you see on the walls. There's a parallel to astronomy, isn't there?
The more you know, the more you're impressed. But I think that even a person who's not a scientist can get a flavor of that wonder just by finding out about the discoveries that we've made. And, you know, what NASA has done is really the heritage of the American people. They have supported it. I'm privileged to be kind of a child of Sputnik, that I've gotten caught up in this, but it's really the taxpayers that have supported us. You know, it's not like some little personal, you know, venture I'm on. I wanted to, in my book, bring the whole contributions that they've made back to them. That is really the number one reason why I wrote the book.
How much has our understanding of the solar system evolved over the last half century or so?
It has, I would say, been immense. I mean, basically, the planets were just pinpoints of light. I mean, there were a couple little things you could see on Mars and the red spot of Jupiter. But for the most part, we have transformed these pinpoints of light to geologic worlds. And not only geologic worlds, but worlds that are, as I call them, worlds familiar. Worlds that have geologic formations and processes that are like those on Earth. There are just amazing things. The volcanoes on Io, the plumes, the active ice volcanoes on Enceladus, the liquid lakes on Titan. Now, they're not water. They're liquid hydrocarbons. But a lot of the features we see on Titan are uncannily like those we see on Earth. You know, Lake Powell looks just like the lakes we see on Titan. So they really are fantastic but familiar. That is kind of the thing. Scientists are beginning to look at things that happen on the planets as processes. You know, not just, oh, let's study Mars, let's study Titan, let's study Pluto. We see the common processes, geologic things that happen on the planets and the moons that are common. That's where we've come now.
The work you've done over your professional career has put you in enough situations that in a lot of chapters in this book, the story becomes pretty personal. And because of that, I want to jump forward to kind of the middle of the book and the story that you tell about Enceladus, that moon of Saturn. Because I think telling that story is not just, in part, it tells us not just how planetary science works, but all of science. Tell this story that, you know, started for you, at least anyway, on an evening in January of 2005.
Yes, I remember that also pretty vividly. I was sitting in my office. It was a Friday afternoon. It was about 6 o'clock, and of course it was dark out, and I was just kind of dreaming about what I was going to do for the weekend and everything, and which was probably work. You know, things were pretty busy back then because we had just gotten into orbit, and had a lot of data to reduce. And I was jolted by this phone call, and Trina Ray was on the other end of the line. She said, "Bonnie, you know, we have this picture of Enceladus, and we think there's a plume. Can I send it over to you and have a look at it?" So she sent it by email, and I looked at it, and sure enough, there it really looked like some kind of a atmosphere or plume off the side of Enceladus. Now, scientists had been talking about plumes on Enceladus for some time. This wasn't new, because Enceladus looked like it was coated in snow. It's kind of a winter wonderland. It is as bright as newly fallen snow. It reflects nearly all the solar radiation that comes on it. So we were pretty certain that there had to be some active geology. Fresh means active in planetary science. So seeing this plume was quite a revelation, but not unsurprising. So I immediately, you know, got to work, and I called some members of the imaging team. I didn't know it at the time, but there was a disagreement on the imaging team about whether there really was a plume on Enceladus, whether there really was active. And, you know, one of the points I make in my book is this is what drives science. Disagreement drives science. You have to disagree. You have to go out on a limb and say something provocative so scientists will challenge you, so scientists will look at data, not only that would support you, but could refute you. So that's kind of what was happening there. It had already started with the imaging team.
And you had some pretty strong disagreements.
Yeah, we did. We really did. The first kind of, I would say, solid clue, Michelle Daugherty, who is the principal investigator of the magnetometer on Cassini, had seen this draping of what looked like an atmosphere of Enceladus around the magnetic field. The magnetic field just seemed to kind of drape around Enceladus. And she had a hunch that there is, you know, maybe not a plume, but an atmosphere. There was something there, you know, because otherwise it wouldn't drape around, you know, around what is a solid surface. She argued and had the support of the group I was leading that was planning the satellite observations to go to swoop down much closer. You know, most of these flybys are about 1,000 kilometers, but we made the argument to swoop down just to a few hundred kilometers. And Bob Mitchell, who was the project manager at that time, approved it. And we went down, low, and that was when we found the smoking gun.
Yeah.
We basically found this boiling cauldron. John Spencer and his team, with the infrared spectrometer, found a boiling cauldron at the south pole of Enceladus, where it should be the coldest part of Enceladus. It was actually very warm. In fact, we know now that the temperature there is very close to the melting point of ice, enabling liquid water to come up. Later on, Carolyn Porco had gotten images of the plume, spectacular images of the plume. And there was a lot of disagreement at the beginning, but, you know, we all came to some kind of a conclusion that there is this incredible active geology going on at the South Pole of Enceladus. And we're still studying it, and there's still disagreements about, you know, what causes it, and, you know, is there enough heat, or how much heat is there? There's a lot of disagreement, but there's nothing like it in the solar system.
JPL senior research scientist Bonnie Barati will return to talk more about her new book and the world's fantastic She and It Explore. This is Planetary Radio.
I'm Casey Dreyer, the Planetary Society's Director of Space Policy. In the past 5 years, our members have helped us to achieve every single advocacy priority we've had. But we have a new Congress, we have a new president, and soon, a new NASA administrator. Decisions are being made right now that will impact NASA for a generation. You can learn more about this at planetary.org/advocacy. Thank you.
Hi, Emily Lakdawalla here with big news from the Planetary Society. We're rolling out a new membership plan with great benefits and expanded levels of participation. At the Planetary Society, passionate space fans like you join forces to create missions, nurture new science and technology, advocate for space, and educate the world. Details are at planetary.org/membership. I'll see you around the solar system.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan, this week talking with astronomer and planetary scientist Bonnie Barati about her new book, Worlds Fantastic, Worlds Familiar. The JPL researcher has had a hand in much of the hard work and thrilling science she describes.
There is so much in the book that we have been able to discover because of these missions throughout the solar system. Also, of course, the improvement of observation from here on Earth. I wonder what you're most looking forward to. You know, the stuff that's already in the works in the next decade or so, roughly.
Well, I think two things. First of all, to go back to some of these amazing worlds. You mentioned Enceladus, but I think a mission to Titan, because I think in many respects it's the most Earth-like planet. Well, it's not a planet, I know. It's a moon, but it's the most Earth-like body. It's got lakes. It may have caves. It's got these what we call fluvial features, which are landforms formed by flowing hydrocarbons. So I think going back is very important. But also there's the whole draw of new exploration. The New Horizons mission, which explored Pluto, wow, it's almost 2 years ago, is going on to this smaller Kuiper Belt object. And whenever we've gone on to a new object, a different object, we just could not predict what it was going to be like.
We always get surprises.
We always get surprises. So this, even though it's just a little, it's even smaller than Phoebe, this 2014 MU69 doesn't have a name yet. We don't know what we could find. So there's exploration and there's going deeper. It's those two things that drive us.
OSIRIS-REx.
That's the other thing. I mean, that is another primitive body, a C-type, what's known as a carbonaceous type asteroid. And it's a rare, now that really is an asteroid. It's a rare type of carbonaceous asteroid. We're going to get a sample and try to see what the processes were that formed the solar system from the very beginning.
Fingers crossed, Europa Clipper.
Yes, that I think is going to be our next what we call flagship mission in the outer solar system. Of course, there's the Mars missions, which we haven't even had time to talk about, but it does look like Europa Clipper is going to be NASA's priority going forward.
Do you have any doubt that the solar system holds many more surprises for us?
I'm certain that it does. I mean, we really don't even know if we... The big question is there life elsewhere in the solar system, either on Mars, hunkered down, or in one of these ocean worlds, the subsurface oceans that are on Europa and Enceladus? Is there primitive bacterial life there? We haven't even answered that question. So, yeah, there are many more surprises. There are many more objects to look at, and I'm just kind of, you know, handing the baton on to, you know, younger generations. I've been really privileged to be part of the Sputnik generation and be part of the team that has made these great discoveries. But it's time for a younger generation to step forth and continue.
And they seem to be. So much of what we've talked about, and much, much more, is in this beautiful book, a real tribute to what's out there for us to find across the solar system and beyond our solar system, because you have a great chapter about exoplanets and even the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Lots of beautiful illustrations in Worlds Fantastic, Worlds Familiar. It's from Cambridge University Press. I'm going to put you on the spot. You brought another copy. I've already got mine. Can we give away a copy of the book?
Yeah, sure. I'd be glad to.
We'll do that in this week's Space Trivia Contest with Bruce Betts that's coming up next.
Yeah, great.
Thanks again.
Okay, thanks so much, Matt, for having me.
Bonnie Baratti is a senior research scientist at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory that's operated by NASA, by Caltech, the California Institute of Technology. She primarily studies icy moons, comets, and asteroids. She's a past chair of the American Astronomical Society's Division for Planetary Sciences. And as you heard, she's the U.S. project scientist for the brilliantly successful Rosetta Comet mission. You're going to find her name on more than 200 papers, along with an asteroid and this great new book. Time for What's Up on Planetary Radio. Bruce Betts is the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society. He's back to tell us about the night sky and more stuff. Welcome.
Thank you.
I have to tell this story to the audience. I just gave you a little preview. I came to the office this week, hadn't been there in a while, found a box on my desk, opened it up, and inside is a brand spanking new audio cable, really nice audio cable. XLR for you techies. And I thought, I didn't order a cable. and then I find the letter. Apparently, the people at this company, Rapco Horizon, heard my rant to you about how much I hate cables. They said, as a gesture of goodwill, please find enclosed a complimentary microphone cable with special imprint. Kudos on your great radio program, Ad Astra, from your listeners at the Rapco Horizon Company. Thank you, guys.
That's really cool. Well, I want to rant about gold, because I've just been unsatisfied with the gold that I have. And so, I don't know. If anyone has great gold, feel free to send it to me.
All right. What's up?
So, I've stopped this. Get down to space. Get up to space.
Yes, exactly.
Mars really getting tough to see low in the west shortly after sunset. But you just turn, you look up, and the brightest thing out there in kind of the southeast is Jupiter, looking super bright. And Saturn being much friendlier to those of us who don't like to get up early. 10, 11 p.m. over there in the east, looking kind of yellowish. And Venus dominating the east in the pre-dawn sky.
Oh, that was short and sweet.
Well, I had to make up for your rant about... Anyway, this week in space history, we move on to that. In 1973, Skylab was launched. First U.S. space station. It was fun.
Yeah, you know what I loved most about Skylab were the little pads that you could run on. You could run
around. Oh, yeah, it was like the little hamster wheel.
Exactly.
They'd run in circles, and then they'd lose their balance and go flying around.
And I always wondered, you know, if they ran enough laps on that, did they start the Skylab spinning the other way? They could get artificial gravity that way.
Or if they just brought a herd of hamsters.
Okay, you really got me with that one. Hamsters with gold strapped to their backs.
Yeah. I started thinking about the physics of that, and it got weird in a hurry. We move on to something more serious, like random space fact.
Sort of a sad clown impression of random space fact.
Oh. So the Apollo Lunar Excursion Module, later referred to as just the Lunar Module, was the first manned spacecraft to operate exclusively in the vacuum of space. So it never operated in the Earth's atmosphere, and that's why it got to look all spidery. We move on to the trivia contest. What letter is used to classify the most powerful class of solar flares as observed from near Earth in X-rays? Just to be clear. How'd we do, Matt?
This challenged people. It depressed the number of entries slightly, but everybody who wrote in got it right. I'm delighted that Connie Shee of Knoxville, Tennessee, was chosen by random.org. She says the letter X is used to classify the most powerful class of solar flares.
That is correct. They put numbers after it if they want to say it's even more powerful, X1, X2, etc.
In fact, we got a note from Gabe Eggers, and in addition to some other people, who said the most powerful solar flare measured with modern methods was 2003. It was an X28, and that was because that's as far as the sensors could read up.
Wow.
We got a haiku from Samantha Glick in Minneapolis. Magnetic field lines snap to make powerful flares. X-class are biggest. Finally, this, if you think that people haven't actually suffered from these, well, then you don't know Randy DePasquale. He says, I will remember this answer forever because I attended the Antares Orb 3 launch, NASA social event, but the launch was delayed due to an incoming X-class flare, and I was unable to stay long enough to see the launch. And then he adds, shakes an angry fist toward the sun.
Curse you, son.
I think the sun shrugged him off. That's it. We're ready to go on to another contest.
Back to the moon, back to the Apollo Lunar Excursion Module. With legs deployed, how tall was the Apollo Lunar Excursion Module? That's the ascent stage and the descent stage. Just to be clear, together, legs deployed, go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Great question. And I've always thought of it as LEM, you know? I like having
the LEM
in there. You've got until the 17th. That'd be Wednesday, May 17th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us the answer to this one. You will, if you're chosen and you got it right, you will receive a Planetary Radio t-shirt, Natch, a 200-point iTelescope.net account worth a couple $100, American, worldwide network of nonprofit telescopes, or worldwide nonprofit network of telescopes. And as we were just saying at the end of the conversation with Bonnie Baratti, her new book, World's Fantastic, World's Familiar. I have your copy right in my hand. We will ship that out to you as well.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about what six colors you would use for your personally designed Rubik's Cube. Thank you, and good night.
Well, I'd start with infrared and ultraviolet and go on.
Whoa,
from there.
Dude.
He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Science and Technology for the Planetary Society, and he just completed his class at CSU Dominguez Hills. You're all done, right? Congrats.
I am. I'm all done, but every one of the classes is archived at Planet. You can find them at planetary.org/BettsClass, B-E-T-T-S, class.
Check it out. Great intro to astronomy. He joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its fantastic members. Danielle Gunn is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Clear skies.